again. Flames burst across the dummy's surface as the blade made contact, leaving wide cracks in the protective shield. Sarah was grinning as she turned back toward me.
Get it now?
I nodded, impressed.
It absorbs and discharges mana.
How do you make it work?
I just think about the spell that I want to absorb, and it pulls it toward the blade, then absorbs it. The range seems to be about 10 feet, and it isn't automatic. I have to mentally command the sword to do it.
I rubbed my chin. The fact that it can read your intent is interesting. That's a pretty sophisticated enchantment. How do you discharge the stored mana?
By hitting something. That doesn't seem to require any special effort, just a certain amount of pressure on the impact. Means I have to be careful. Dropping the sword from far enough will set it off.
Can it absorb more than one spell at a time?
Nope. Have to discharge the last spell before you can store another one.
That was unfortunate, because I was hoping to be able to mix mana types inside. Having a relatively safe and reliable way to make compound forms of mana would be extremely useful.
What's the capacity on it?
Karis interjected there.
I've been advising against trying to test that. If we hit the limit, the whole sword could explode. The last time I heard about an artifact exploding, we had to take a city off the map.
I winced at that thought.
That's bad, yeah. But we really need to find out before she can use it in a combat situation, otherwise it could explode at an inopportune time.
Right, I'll make sure we break it precisely at explode o'clock.
Sarah folded her arms. I laughed. That's not what I meant. A powerful enchanter or diviner might be able to figure out the capacity. There are spells for testing material capacities, similar to what my mana watch uses for testing personal mana limits.
Thought of that.
Sarah set the sword down on a nearby table.
Problem is that no one seems to know what the sword is even made out of. Thought the blade was just some kind of hardened mana at first, but it's definitely not.
Karis walked over to the sword and tapped on the blade. It's similar to a type of crystal I saw once before. It was a green gemstone with ancient enchantments. Unfortunately, I don't know what that was made out of either. Normally, I can use stone sorcery to get a feel for the composition of most types of stone, but the enchantments on this artifact prevent me from sensing it properly.
That might block enchanters or diviners in the same way.
I took a look at it with my attunement on. The aura around it was colorless right now, which didn't tell me much. It clearly wasn't just a quartz-level item, so it probably used a completely different form of enchanting than modern ones, much like the Jaden Box.
I'll see if I can start researching spells for analyzing items. It could be useful, considering the number of magical items we've come across that don't use standard runes. I don't know if the spells will work, but it's worth trying.
Sarah nodded.
Thanks.
Have you figured out anything else about it?
Karis shrugged a shoulder.
It has some standard magic sword properties. Tougher than steel, but it's hard to say if that's because of enchantments or the crystal itself. It's sharp, but nothing particularly impressive. Then there's this.
He picked up the sword, then hit the target with it several times in rapid succession. I could hear a faint ringing in the air each time he struck, with a slightly different tone, like musical notes. I blinked.
That's really strange. Is it doing anything other than making sound?
Can't tell.
Karis set the sword back down.
Might be some kind of vibration-based attack, but if so, it doesn't seem particularly potent. It seems to change based on where I hit the target, so it might also be some kind of information for the wielder.
Information?
I think the tone might indicate points the sword considers more vulnerable than others. If it was built for use against powerful monsters, for example, the tone might be useful for finding areas where scales are thinner, or that sort of thing.
Like knocking on dungeon walls to find a hollow spot.
Huh. I thought of some pretty strange ideas for enchantments over the years, but that definitely wasn't the type of thing I'd ever considered.
That's weird, but I suppose it could be useful.
I thought about it for another moment.
Does it make a different noise when you have a spell stored inside?
Karis's eyes and lips narrowed as he considered.
Haven't noticed the difference. Why?
If the sword is about storing and distributing mana, and it also has some kind of weak point detection, maybe it can be used to detect for elemental weaknesses as well.
Not bad.
Karras tapped his fingers against the table. I hadn't thought about it, but that does make sense. I generally don't bother with figuring out monster weaknesses.
Probably because you're so powerful, you don't have to worry about them, I realized with a hint of amusement. But the rest of us mere mortals need to strategize more.
Wish we had an easier way to test that, I finally said. I could build an elementally aligned shield sigil, but it'll take a while.
I considered the idea of testing it on a summoned elemental for an instant, but then I realized that was horrifically immoral and dismissed it entirely. Fortunately, no one else brought it up. Another idea did occur to me, though.
Karras, what about that bond you can make with weapons? Wouldn't that give you a better idea of how it works?
Sarah frowned.
We talked about that. There are some risks with trying to make a contract with an artifact with unknown properties, especially when we know at least one of them involves absorbing mana. We're probably going to try it, but we wanted to figure out what we can from safer tests before we make a decision.
That sounded wise. Have you figured out if there are only specific types of mana it can absorb?
Seems like any of them, at least from what we can tell.
Sarah formed a little sphere of ice in her hand, picked the sword back up, and absorbed the spell into the weapon.
There were a lot of possible applications for that.
Could you store a healing spell inside and then use it to heal someone later?
Sarah blinked.
You want me to use this as a healing sword? Really? That's your brilliant non-standard application for this?
Hey, I just learned about it. Besides, you know that'd be hilarious.
I folded my arms.
Okay, better one. Teleportation.
Karras whistled.
That's not a bad idea, actually. Most people around here block offensive teleportation with their shrouds. But if you could get the sword to hit them directly, it'd be inside the shroud and completely ignore that defense.
He glanced at Sarah.
You've got travel sorcery. You should try that.
She shook her head.
Summoners can learn teleportation spells at higher attunement levels, but I'm a long way from that point. Especially now.
Her expression sank.
You'll catch back up.
Karras patted her on the shoulder. I winced on her behalf, but she didn't seem to mind the contact. She'd never been as sensitive to random people touching her.
Maybe Corrin could help with that.
We've talked about it, and I don't think using my attunement to strengthen her is a good idea while she's still recovering. Overcharging her mana is what got her into this in the first place.
Agreed,
Sarah added quickly, with obvious nervousness in her voice.
Maybe after I get back to the point where I was before the spire.
Karras glanced at me, then back to Sarah.
No need to hurry, I suppose.
From his tone, it was obvious he disagreed with the decision. He didn't seem like the type to prioritize safety in general, so I could see why. Fortunately, he didn't push. He jumped back to the last topic instead.
Anyway, teleportation was a good idea. Maybe you can find some other clever things to store in there eventually. For now, though, it's an amazing defensive tool, if nothing else.
That was certainly true. Being able to pull a spell right out of the air was a great way to stop an attack spell without much effort. I thought Sarah would be missing out by using it exclusively for defense, but she could make that choice on her own.
I'll think on that some more, I offered, turning to head back out. And I'll get to looking up item identification spells.
I'd already done a bit of research on the lesser identify spell, and I knew the theory of how to cast it, but I hadn't practiced with it yet. Besides that, I needed a stronger spell to get much useful information.
I'm sure you'll come up with something that helps our enemies slightly less than a healing sword if you try hard enough,
Sarah snickered.
But one more thing before you go.
I paused.
I'm not just tinkering with a sword. I'm getting back in fighting shape in general. I appreciate you all putting up with my weakness during the last test, but I'm done with dragging everyone else down. Next time we have a group exam, I'm going to be the one leading the way.
I grinned.
I'll look forward to that.
I'll need you to do more than just that. I'm going to need a consistent sparring partner.
I frowned. Why not just train with all of us?
I will to some extent, of course, but Patrick always holds back, and I can't get as much out of fighting close-range fighters like Mara and Derek.
I could see the logic there. Her attunement was built for summoning, which she lacked the mana to do effectively right now, and ranged combat. Training against melee fighters was still useful for her, but it didn't let her practice her main skills. Patrick was a better match for her, but I didn't disagree with her evaluation. He'd want to go easy on her to avoid bruising her ego, but that would stunt her ability to train effectively. Okay, I nodded. You're on, Sarah grinned.
Meet on the rooftop in 2 hours?
I'll look forward to it.
Over the next few days, I spent a bit of my time practicing the Lesser Identify spell. When I cast Lesser Identify on an object, another aura would appear around it that only I could see. Rather than demonstrating the power of an object like a traditional shroud, the aura displayed by Lesser Identify was color-coded to show the highest concentration of mana in the object. For example, when I cast it on Selyse Leanne, it showed a blue aura indicating water mana. Or maybe ice mana. I couldn't actually tell the difference because both water and ice had different shades of blue auras, and I didn't have a lot of samples to compare. Because I found the basic colors hard to tell apart from composite ones like ice and lightning, I didn't find this spell particularly useful. It was a good foundation for more powerful information-gathering spells, though, and I used it as a way to practice using my mental mana without causing myself the intense distress of draining it continuously. Once I was confident I could cast it properly, I tested it on Saris. The resulting aura was pure white and sort of sparkly, which didn't correspond to anything in my book. That was neat, but not very useful. I told Sarah about the results and promised to continue studying. Beyond that, I tested it on Trials of Judgment. I'd been looking for good ways to figure out how it worked, and this was my first real chance that didn't involve asking someone for help. Unfortunately, the result was nothing at all. No glowing aura. The book probably had runes to protect it from detection magic, and they were stronger than my spell. I was still tempted to take the book apart to find the runes, but I resisted the urge. It wasn't worth the risk of causing the book damage. I looked up some more powerful identification spells, but none of the ones in the Quartz and Carnelian range were powerful enough to break through the book's magical defenses, and they didn't give me any more information. I did find a Sunstone-level version that was just called Identify. That would tell me several more pieces of information about an item, but it cost 80 mana to cast, and I couldn't manage that yet. I'll get there at some point, though. The more important discovery from all of the practice was that I could cast information-gathering spells in general, even if I wasn't a diviner. There were a few things that required the diviner attunement, like making memory crystals, but most of them just required having mental mana. That knowledge gave me several new options to explore. I practiced another spell, one I'd first seen when researching diviners, and left the manor. I had some tracking to do. The Arrow of Direction spell literally made a glowing arrow that pointed to my target. There were several variations, but I could only cast the most basic version, which lasted a few seconds. It also only worked on targets within a few miles. Finally, it required a physical item connected to the target to use as a focus. Pieces of the target's body were best. Blood, hair, that sort of thing. But something invested with the target's mana would work as well. In this case, I used a business card. I didn't find my target at a bar or a seedy casino like I'd pictured. Instead, they were walking at a park just north of campus, accompanied by a small, intensely fluffy dog. I found myself hesitating when I got a few feet away, uncertain how to start the conversation. Fortunately or not, they did it for me.
Corin, when I told you to track me down, this wasn't exactly what I had in mind.
In spite of the chastising message, Sheridan was grinning brightly. I waved the business card. I figured the rune on the card stored some kind of information on how I was supposed to contact you, but I didn't have a spell for extracting that information, and honestly, just using your mana to track you seemed faster.
Sheridan laughed.
I applaud your corner-cutting abilities. You passed the test.
I nodded. I'd expected there was a reason the card didn't just have an address on it.
I thought about just asking Derek where to find you, but I figured that would have been less impressive.
You're quite right. He'd have sent you to my house, and I'd have to be more formal there.
Hold on a second. Sheridan reached into a bag at their side, retrieving a small ball and tossing it in front of the dog. The dog rushed toward it, barking lightly. The ball began to roll away on its own.
That'll keep Mr. Eviscerator entertained for a while.
You named your dog Eviscerator?
Mr. Eviscerator. The title is important. He's very polite. Sheridan clasped their hands together. So, business or pleasure?
That sounded like a trap question. Maybe a little bit of both? It would be a pleasure to do business with you. Sheridan chuckled again.
I'll give you credit for the effort, but your intentions are obvious. We can keep it professional today.
What do you need? Sarah doing okay? I nodded. She seems to be recovering fine. That's not what I'm here about right now.
Sheridan's expression shifted for a moment, giving me a hint that my answer had been unexpected.
Good, good. What can I help you with, then?
I need information. Hard to get information.
Well, then, you came to the right place, assuming you can afford it.
Let's go have a seat, shall we?
Sheridan glanced back toward Mr. Eviscerator, who was still chasing the rolling ball, and then led me toward a nearby park bench. There were other people in the park, mostly students and a few other local civilians, but no one that looked to be close enough to overhear our conversation.
So, what do you want to know about?
Everything. But I can't afford to ask about everything I want to know. I'm going to have to get some of my answers from cheaper sources.
A few subjects. Some we might not be able to discuss in public.
I glanced around again, but there still wasn't anyone within earshot, as long as we weren't yelling.
And what are we starting with?
I'd like to know what you know about Tenjin's disappearance.
Sheridan raised an eyebrow. That's not exactly a small issue.
You sure you want to get involved with that sort of thing?
I already am. How do you think I got my second attunement?
Ooh, fascinating. Sheridan folded their arms.
Okay, I'll do a pure information trade for a bit about that. Elaborate about your arbiter attunement, and I'll tell you a bit of what I know.
I nodded. It was a better trade than I would have hoped for. I wasn't sure I could trust Sheridan, but there were enough people who knew what had happened with Katashi that I didn't think this was a particularly difficult secret to discover without my help, especially for someone with Sheridan's apparent resources.
So, remember that time when Mizuchi attacked everyone outside the spire a little while ago?
I summarized what had happened with getting my brand, then retrieving someone for Katashi and bringing them to the spire. I didn't tell Sheridan about Vera's identity or what happened with Orden's betrayal. If information had a price, I could sell that later.
Based on your account, Sheridan began, I think you would be better off asking me a different question. You most likely know more about Tenjin's situation than I do.
I frowned. I assumed that kind of thing would be your area of expertise. Forbidden knowledge and such?
Not everyone who deals in information has the same focus. Forbidden knowledge is a very broad subject matter. I happen to deal primarily in forbidden magical knowledge as opposed to political secrets, the affairs of the gods, and that sort of thing.
That definitely limited my avenues of conversation, but it did provide me with a better idea of what I should be asking about.
Okay, a more specific question then.
Are you working with my brother Tristan? On whatever he's been up to?
No.
Just no?
You're asking because of my sister's dealings, I assume?
I nodded. And because of your association with Wid?
Ah, Sheridan smiled. You gave away something you shouldn't have there. I wasn't aware your brother had an association with Wid.
I just assumed
that people who work for Wid would be aware of each other. That would completely defeat the point of some of our positions. We are often asked to spy on each other, in fact. Some portion of any group entrusted with forbidden knowledge is going to abuse that knowledge. The fear that we'll be discovered by one of Wid's other servants is one of the factors that prevents those abuses. For all I know, you could be working for Wid right now and seeing if I slip and say something I'm not supposed to.
Wouldn't you have means of identifying each other, though, in case you needed to share information?
Sheridan waved a hand.
We have identification phrases and such, but that can be faked. In general, we simply report to our superiors, and they tell us any other contacts we need to know about.
That sounded extremely frustrating, but I could understand the reasoning behind it.
Okay, were you approached about working with whatever group Tristan is working for?
Ah, a much better question, and the answer is yes. I deemed the risks too extreme. As such, they did not tell me any important details. As I said, I likely know less than you do.
I rubbed my chin, processing that. Okay, speculate with me for a moment. Who could be the mastermind behind Tenjin's disappearance? Who would have the resources to coordinate an effort that could keep him gone for this long?
Without knowing where Tenjin is, there's very little I can do to answer that.
Ask something else.
This wasn't going the way I wanted, but I slowly nodded and considered.
What can you tell me about the Whispers as a whole?
Sheridan shrugged.
Not much. For starters, there isn't just one group of Whispers. They're really separate organizations, each dedicated to one of the visages.
And you're a Whisper of Wid?
Sheridan shook their head.
No. Whispers are secret. I'm actually publicly in Wid's employ.
What does that make you, then? A priest?
Not in the slightest. I'm a magical theory researcher. All of the visages have people like me who serve in various roles without any sort of fancy religious status or title.
I don't suppose you could tell me who some Whispers of Wid are.
Sheridan shook their head with a grave expression.
No. And before you ask, not at any price. That's not the kind of information that I can sell.
Can you tell me more general information about their organization, then? Hierarchy, roles, positions?
Sheridan shook their head.
Sorry. I don't like being this evasive, but you're better off asking an actual Whisper. And even then, they're probably not going to tell you.
I sighed.
Okay, different approach then. Do you know anything about anyone else who might be working directly with Tenjin's kidnappers?
Yes, your brother. But you already knew that, didn't you?
I don't think I should confirm that.
Ha! Good, you're learning.
Sheridan glanced over to their dog, then back to me.
If these are the only sorts of questions you have, I think we should wrap this discussion up. I'm not going to be able to help you much with it.
Okay, something more in your area of expertise, then. I pointed to my right hand. I'd like to learn more about my Arbiter attunement.
Ah,
Sheridan smiled.
Now that is more my area of expertise. I take it you already know the basics?
Yes. I know how to transfer mana to others, either to restore their mana or exceed their current maximum capacity. But I've been thinking about the implications of that and how they might relate to how I received my attunement in the first place.
In what way?
When I transfer my mana to someone, I can permanently increase their safe capacity, but only by a fraction. And I've been told that I can only do that safely about once a week. This is presumably because the body can only acclimate to a certain amount of additional mana at once.
Sheridan nodded.
That's correct. When Katashi gave me the brand, though, it seemed to be storing a tremendous amount of mana inside. And I also saw Katashi enhance someone else's attunement, increasing it by an entire attunement level. In both cases, that would involve an increase in mana that is much greater than what I've been told is safe to give someone with my attunement. I considered whether or not that might be related to Katashi being more powerful than I am, but that doesn't make sense. It's the target's body that is relevant, because it's their capacity that is being strained by the additional mana.
Sheridan's smile broadened. You see a contradiction. Someone's body can only handle a certain amount of mana, but Katashi somehow bypassed that restriction in both cases.
Meaning that either he was willingly risking our health by giving us an amount of mana that would be unsafe, or, more likely, that he has a method of giving people large amounts of power without compromising their safety.
I took a breath.
I want that method.
Sheridan sighed and scratched the back of their head.
Of course you do. Don't you have any easy questions?
I chuckled.
What's your favorite food?
I said easy ones.
Okay. What are you offering? For the first question or the second one?
for information about Katashi's methods. I reached into my bag and pulled out the mana regeneration bracer.
I tested it. It works.
Sheridan shook their head. A few weeks of testing isn't going to be enough to satisfy me.
I'd expected that.
I pulled a hairpin out of my hair and offered it to Sheridan.
What's this?
I smiled.
I could tell you for the right price.
You're cute, but hiding the value of what you're negotiating with isn't going to get you anywhere.
It's a magic lockpick. Put it into a lock. It opens it.
Sheridan turned the hairpin over in their hand, considering.
Interesting, but no.
They handed it back to me.
I'll make this a little easier for you.
Use your Arbiter attunement on me.
That's all?
I want to know what it feels like. And it should permanently increase my mana, if only a little.
That's nothing to scoff at, even at my level of power.
I nodded. Sheridan extended their hand. I removed my glove, took Sheridan's hand, and channeled mana into them.
Tingles a little bit.
Don't move.
Sorry.
I continued concentrating until my hand burned, then released Sheridan's hand.
Interesting.
Sheridan flexed their hand experimentally, examining it.
Thank you for the experience.
So, what was the hidden objective behind that? Sheridan's eyes fluttered.
What makes you say I had a hidden objective?
Your personality?
An excellent answer.
Sheridan smirked.
And you're right. But I won't answer that particular question.
You'll find out eventually.
As for your previous question, however, I can give a little bit of insight.
What can you tell me?
Sheridan leaned back. Are you aware that attunement designs have changed over time?
I nodded. There are different generations of attunements. Either the goddess herself or the visages are still improving them somehow.
Correct. One of the elements of attunement design that has changed over time is how quickly they can grow.
Meaning that it used to be harder for your attunements to get stronger?
Mostly easier, I believe. Although I haven't studied the details of every individual generation of attunement.
But why make those sorts of changes? And if there are mechanisms in place for that, how do they work?
Excellent questions.
Sheridan retrieved something from their pouch. The mana watch I'd given them.
You made this little device to measure the amount of mana that someone can safely use. Every attunement has something similar built in. Or several somethings, really. Functions for measuring the amount of mana in the body, and storage functions that determine how the values have changed over time, and also functions for determining the health of the body.
I could follow the logic. So the attunement stores what your last maximum mana was, and continually tests you to see if you meet certain conditions. If you do, your maximum mana increases.
And at certain thresholds, the attunement unlocks entirely new functions,
Sheridan explained.
Carnelian, Sunstone, all of those levels are mana thresholds built into the attunement. And they did not always exist.
That was new to me.
They didn't? The first attunements just gave all their abilities to the attuned immediately. The result was a form of mana poisoning that was almost always fatal. Attunement levels and the safety thresholds for mana growth are designed to prevent that.
Okay, that explains a bit, but it doesn't... I stopped as it began to make sense to me.
Katashi didn't make my friend's attunement more powerful. He fundamentally changed how it works.
Sheridan nodded.
I can't say for certain, but that's what I suspect. He most likely changed the values in the rune to say that she was ready for a higher level attunement. In theory, the safety functions in the attunement would still prevent it from flooding their body with too much mana all at once. Your friend's mana capacity probably increased gradually over the course of several weeks at the maximum possible rate that the attunement deemed safe. And Marissa spent those few weeks feeling sick and underperforming.
Still, I knew a lot of people that would be happy to be able to have their attunement level increased rapidly without any significant effort.
There had to be a greater downside than I was seeing.
If that sort of thing is a possibility, why aren't all of our attunements designed to increase in power automatically by a certain rate every day?
Every time you cast a spell,
your body acclimates to using that type of mana. Using mana types in amounts that your body is not acclimated to properly can cause your body harm. If your body had a tremendous amount of mana, but you never used mana before, and you cast a spell that used even a tenth of it, you'd kill yourself. Because of that, attunements generally require a degree of mana usage before your capacity increases. Why would Katashi make an exception, then, if it's an important safety function? He was probably able to evaluate your friend's situation and determine that they could handle it. For example, some types of mana are safer than others. You can safely have and wield more life mana in your body than fire mana. If your friend was a mender, for example, Katashi may have been able to increase their power with minimal risk. I nodded. Marissa was a guardian, and life was one of her mana types. Her attunement was generally defensive in nature. It made sense to me that there would be a lower risk of damage from saturating her body with extra mana. She also trained constantly, and it was possible her body was able to handle a higher amount of mana than what her attunement was giving her. The overall answer made sense to me, but it was disappointing. It meant that there was no quick and easy way for me to just change someone's attunement to emerald and give them a tremendous amount of power in an instant, even if I figured out how Katashi had done what he had done. Still, there were avenues I could explore with this knowledge. If Katashi somehow knew that Marissa could handle more mana than she was currently getting, maybe I could figure out how he knew that and learn to do the same. If so, I could potentially accelerate the power growth of other people when it was safe to do so. And there were some other options I'd have to think about as well. What about things that increase mana capacity without exercise, like Lavrus fruits and enhancement elixirs? How do they work? I'm not an expert on those, but there are a few ways they could work. Lavrus fruits and similar foods probably strengthen the body in ways that help it tolerate more mana. It's possible they also simply use up some of your mana in the digestion process, which would effectively be the same as casting a spell. Sheridan took a breath and then continued. Enhancement elixirs work more like your attunement. They flood the body with mana. That can be useful in moderation, but as you've seen with your own attunement, there's a maximum benefit you can achieve without causing the body harm. I rubbed at my chin, thinking. Okay. But none of that explains how the brand worked that Katashi gave me, or how he changed that into an attunement. You're quite right. That's something different. Unfortunately, it's not something I'm allowed to explain. You sure there's nothing else you can tell me? Annabelle Farron. I blinked. What? Head researcher for artificial attunements in Kaelford. If you really want to know how that brand worked, or how to give someone else an attunement in general, you should talk to her. That sounded like something that I absolutely needed to do, but that I couldn't do immediately. Kaelford was weeks away by train, and I wasn't done with the school year, and even if I was, I didn't find it likely I'd be able to slip away to Kaelford anytime soon. Still, it was good to finally have a name of someone I could talk to. It was both a lead on how to research my own abilities and potentially relevant to Tengen's whole situation. Annabelle Farron, I repeated. I'll look into that. Thank you. Sheridan smiled. Good. Now I think I've given you enough secrets for one day. I nodded and stood up. Thank you. You've been a tremendous help. Sheridan waved a hand dismissively. You were entertaining. That's a good enough exchange for me. After talking to Sheridan, it occurred to me that I still hadn't heard anything from Derek about the other Thea's sibling. There was a part of me that was still tempted to confront Alora directly. She was a key part to all this, but she was also vastly more powerful and influential than I was, and I wasn't sure if I could deal with her safely. Things clearly hadn't gone as she'd planned, and I didn't know if she was still working with Tristan or not. I decided to ask Derek first. She's not around, he explained. Around? I asked. What does that mean?
She's apparently been in Delano's for a month or so.
I stared at Derek. Isn't that around when the Grand Cathedral in Delano's exploded? I deliberately didn't mention that my mother was also in Delano's.
This news strengthened the possibility that Alora was working with Mother in some way. Derek shrugged.
That doesn't sound like her style.
But kidnapping a visage is?
That was unusual for her, admittedly. But blowing up a major place of worship seems too messy for her. She values precision, organization. The kind of random destruction caused by something like that wouldn't appeal to her.
But you're not ruling out that she could have been involved? Derek sighed.
No, I can't rule anything out at this point. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a part of the same organization that she's working with that caused the explosion. I'm just saying I doubt it was her, personally.
I nodded. Do you have any way of getting in touch with her at a distance? Wayfarer, that sort of thing?
I already sent her a few messages. She hasn't bothered to reply. She's probably still angry about, well, lots of things.
That was inconvenient, but I could work around it. Okay, point me to your wayfarer and I'll contact her.
I'm not sure that's a good idea, Derek frowned. If she's reminded that you exist, that gives her a reason to start paying more attention to you.
Is that a problem?
You don't want Alora Theus's attention unless you can control that attention.
I twisted my lips in concern. I didn't like the sound of that. I've managed to keep up with Sheridan so far. I think it's worth a try.
Denny and Alora are not the same. But it probably won't hurt. Okay, I'll give you some directions and write my friend a note.
Derek gave me a letter, as promised, and sent me to a wayfarer on the other side of town. I wrote a brief letter, hoping it would get me an effective response. Dear Lady Theus, please forgive me for the unsolicited message. This is Corin Cadence, son of Magnus Cadence and Laura Liren. I believe we have both been involved in some matters relating to the Serpent Spire, and I would like to arrange for an exchange of information. It is my hope that we can be of use to each other. Sincerely, Corin Cadence. The wayfarer sent the message for a discount, but it still cost me more than I would have liked. I planned to get back to enchanting and selling goods as soon as the exams were over. For the moment, I just had to hope the message was worth the cost. 2 more weeks passed. It was week 26, with 4 weeks before the winter ball. I was far from idle during that time. I continued training with my Arbiter attunement, using it to bolster Patrick and Marissa's mana, as well as the power of my own Enchanter attunement. Sarah wouldn't let me check her mana for a while, claiming that she didn't like me bothering her all the time. When she finally let me check her a couple weeks after the exam, her mana registered at 24 of 24, more than I'd started the school year with. I still wasn't comfortable using my Arbiter attunement to make her stronger, but she was getting to the point where she was something closer to a functional summoner again. She still had difficulty speaking, though, and pushing herself always resulted in a series of racking coughs. Sheridan apparently paid her a couple more visits and continued to help heal the mana scarring damage, but I wasn't around for any of them. My own attunements were still growing stronger. My Arbiter attunement was up to 121 of 121 mana, and my Enchanter attunement was at 90 of 90. In terms of the rating system, that meant I'd moved up from Carnelian E to Carnelian D for my Enchanter attunement, and my Arbiter attunement was already at Carnelian C. I was well ahead of most of my classmates at this point, although I'd heard about a couple truly outstanding cases that had already gotten even further. After I hit Sunstone, advancing further would get exponentially harder. The mana requirements for each attunement level went up sixfold for each level. People at higher attunement levels generally gained mana more quickly as well, but only a little bit, not 6 times faster. If I wanted to catch up to people like Derek, I'd need to keep finding ways to increase mana capacity faster. It was with that in mind that I spent most of the first week trying to make an enhancement elixir. I had a unique advantage in that endeavor. I didn't need a complex and expensive apparatus to purify my mana. My attunement handled that. Unfortunately, that wasn't the only difficult part of the process. First, I had to figure out how to create mana in a liquid state.
I'd gotten much better at making solid mana crystals, but making liquid mana was a slightly different technique. I asked Vellum for advice. This was, as usual, a mistake.
Oh, making citrine-level potions now? Congratulations, you must have taken 2 years of potions classes and graduated from the university while I wasn't paying attention.
After a few more minutes of exchanging barbs, she made it absolutely clear that I was not ready to make enhancement elixirs, and that she was well aware I would continue to attempt to do so anyway. She was right, of course, but she also wasn't particularly helpful. I dug into books for techniques on mana manipulation and eventually found some practice exercises for making liquid mana that sounded doable. The easiest was just channeling mana into a glass of water. The trick was getting the mana into the water at exactly the right rate so that the water didn't evaporate, solidify, or explode. I mourned the loss of many cups that day. When I finally succeeded in charging a glass of water with mana, the result wasn't an enhancement elixir, or even a mana potion. It was just water with some mana in it. Mana potions were the next logical stage in progression from there, and that involved mixing mana-charged water with specific alchemical agents. Enhancement elixirs required pure mana in liquid form, rather than mana-infused water as a base. After days of effort, I still couldn't get mana to coalesce in that state. And beyond that, an enhancement elixir still required other ingredients, some of which, I learned, were quite expensive. That week wasn't a waste, but it wasn't as much progress as I wanted either. I switched my focus on the following week to something I'd neglected. Life magic. Life was the secondary mana type for my new attunement, and I hadn't done anything with it yet. Ignoring a secondary mana type was pretty common for first-year students. Marissa had barely studied life mana herself, and she'd had it from her guardian attunement since the beginning of the school year. The primary mana types and compound mana types, like lightning, which Patrick could make from a combination of both air and fire, were far more popular. It probably would have been more efficient to wait until my second year, then enroll in a class on life magic, but I had a bad habit of wandering into near-death situations. I didn't want healing magic didn't seem like a priority to be my final words. In fact, I didn't really want to have final words at all, unless they involved something like, at last I have transcended beyond the boundaries of my frail human existence. Not in a metaphor for dying sense, more in an ascending to a higher state of being sense. That sounded pleasant. Unfortunately, healing magic wasn't exactly the type of thing I could master in a week. I learned early on that healing spells involved bombarding a specific part of someone with mana and guiding that mana to rebuild the damaged location. This required a high degree of precision, almost like performing surgery. If I didn't have a firm understanding of what the healing spell was supposed to accomplish, it wouldn't work properly and I could actually do more harm than good. For example, if I found someone with a slice in their leg, I could use a healing spell to patch the hole in the skin. But if I didn't know how the muscle underneath was supposed to be repaired, I could either leave it in a damaged state or heal it incorrectly, making the injury worse. That meant my week of learning healing magic was largely dedicated to studying books on human anatomy. The rest of it was spent on practicing the lesser regeneration spell, which worked like a weaker version of my ring. It caused the body to heal itself faster. It was much slower than a direct healing spell, but it didn't require any skill to use and had a minimal chance of causing harm. I didn't expect to get much utility out of the spell, since it was about a tenth the power of the ring and about a third the power of the bracer. Still, if I was ever in a situation where there were more people injured than I had items to handle, it would potentially be useful. Beyond that, I continued my usual training routines throughout the 2 weeks. Karis continued to work with Marissa and me on general combat, and I started doing some ranged combat practice with Sarah to get her back into fighting shape. When those 2 weeks were up, I had 3 final exams in a row. Understanding attunements was, as I expected, a written exam. I suspected I got an average score on that one. Introductory Runes was also a written exam. That one was considerably easier. I'd been terrible at memorizing attunement runes as a child, but that was because they never had any practical use to me at that age. Now that I was actively enchanting things, I was learning runes on a daily basis, and memorizing them was much easier when I was practicing them all the time. Permanent enchantments, of course, was not a written exam. Professor Vellum would never let us get away with passing her class that easily.
Ah, students! It brings me great joy to see so many of you here, so eager to display what you've learned.
She wasn't even trying to disguise the mockery in her tone. This is going nowhere good. As we sat down, I could see the nervousness in the expressions of my peers. Even the greatest monsters couldn't inspire fear like an old woman who is plotting something.
Oh, no need to be seated. I wouldn't dream of giving your final test in something as dull as a classroom. Please, follow me.
Professor Vellum stepped out of the chamber without another word. We followed after her, most students mumbling suspicious comments to one another. I stayed focused, trying to figure out where exactly we were walking. It wasn't long before I knew. I'd already seen her with another class at the Vaben Stadium, so I shouldn't have been surprised. But the dueling class finals were over, so what was she planning? The arena floor was still covered with the same tiles that we'd used during the dueling match. In addition, there were two tables on the far side of the arena floor. One table held standard enchanting tools like etching rods and measuring implements. The rest of them held a miscellany of assorted items, a vase, children's toys, kitchenware. It looked like someone had dumped out a box of old junk onto the table. And knowing Vellum, that was very likely what had happened.
Stand over here. She positioned the class on the opposite side from the tables. Good.
Vellum folded her hands.
When this year began, I told you this would be your hardest class. While the work up until this point has proven challenging for some, I was referring specifically to this final test. Many of you will fail. Most of you who do will feel that the test was unfair.
I felt my jaw tighten as she continued. She cracked a grin.
That's because it is, of course. This is a terribly unfair test. Not quite as unfair as the spires, however, which is why you need to be properly prepared before you challenge them.
Professor Vellum turned and pointed at the tables behind her.
Those will be your supplies. When I say to begin, you may retrieve a single set of tools and a single item from the other table to enchant.
Some students were already groaning, but that part didn't make me nervous. Not yet.
Your test today is a simple one. Assume you are going into the spire with a group of climbers and you need to prepare. You only have the time and materials to prepare a single item. 10 minutes after we begin, I will begin calling out the names of students, starting from those who have the highest scores. When I call your name, you will present your item to me.
We were already standing, so someone waved to get Vellum's attention. Vellum ignored the student and continued talking.
You may not give me an item you already enchanted before today, or any other magical item, for that matter. You also may not add enchantments to another item you already have on you. You must enchant one of the items from those tables.
Her phrasing on that last line already gave me a slim loophole. I could potentially enchant one of the tools, rather than one of the objects from the other table. But I kept listening.
You may only use the materials within the arena. You may not leave the arena to gather more supplies. If you already happen to be carrying enchanting supplies on you, you may use them. Preparation is key.
I heard several groans at that. I had a few things in my bag that I always kept on me, but not too much. My tools and a few mana crystals were better than nothing, though. Beyond that, I did have several magical items I'd already made or purchased, but I wasn't allowed to turn those in or modify them. I didn't know if they'd be of any help. I did have more materials to work with inside the Jaden box, and the box was in my bag, but showing it here would be a risk I wasn't willing to take.
Now, if you have any questions...
Someone was still waving, so she sighed and pointed to them.
Ms. Weaver?
The student finally put her arm down to speak.
Can we work together?
That
hadn't even been something I'd thought about, shamefully enough.
Why, yes, dear. You can work together. You'd be surprised how few of my students remember that's possible. Any other questions?
Another student waved.
Mr. Thompson.
What happens if we're not finished with an item before the time limit?
You fail, obviously. Anyone else?
No one else waved.
Very well, then.
I shifted my stance.
Your test begins now.
I activated the ring of jumping 3 times in rapid succession, crossing the arena. I was the second person to reach the tables, after a student who had teleported. Miss Weaver, in fact, the girl who had been so enthusiastic about working with others. I found it amusing that she'd so quickly left everyone else behind.
Focus.
I activated my attunement, scanning the tables. Just as I'd suspected, some of the random junk items were already enchanted. Vellum had either put them there as ways for students who couldn't enchant items quickly to pass, or possibly as traps for people who thought they could get away without doing their own work. I opted for the cynical explanation and skipped the enchanted items, instead opting to find something with a good mana capacity, a plain metal circlet. I couldn't tell what type of metal it was, but from the color I suspected it was either iron or steel, either of which had a good enough capacity for my purposes. With that in mind, I found a corner and sat down. I didn't bother grabbing tools. I trusted my own. I had a few ideas on what I could make. The simplest option was to build a stronger shield sigil. I'd already built several shield sigils throughout the year. With my own improved mana capacity and 2 attunements, I could make something with a capacity at least 3 or 4 times higher than the Phoenix sigils. I also considered building a weapon. Among the kitchenware, there were some decent-looking knives, and the benefits of having a weapon in the spire were considerable. With my new training at Life Magic, I was probably capable of making a weak regeneration item with just the tools on hand. That was probably the most tempting prospect, since it was something I doubted anyone else in the class could manage. As far as I knew, everyone else only had an enchanter attunement, and thus no one else had the ability to use life mana. When I thought about the scenario, though, I realized there was something I considered even more important than any of the items above. It was impossible to make what I wanted with just the materials on hand and my own mana. Fortunately, I had a solution. I began carving runes into the circlet. Minutes passed, and I had to stop. I knew most of the runes from memory, but I'd never actually made one of these. So I took the return bell out of my bag, and I began to copy. The jingling of the bell as it came out of my bag drew the attention of a few students. I ignored them.
10 minutes! Ms. Weaver, you're up.
Resh, it's been 10 minutes already?
I didn't know how high I was in the class, but I had to hurry. I finished carving the runes. Then, with the briefest of hesitation, I began to transfer the mana from my return bell's runes into the circlet. The rules of the test had been clear. I couldn't hand in a pre-enchanted item, but I could use my raw materials. And if I broke an item down into raw materials?
That sounded fair.
Probably.
Mr. Holt!
I kept working. It didn't take long to transfer all the runes I was planning to move over. I didn't copy the activation rune, though. I had something more interesting in mind. I looked down at the floor, the tiles still etched with runes. Then I copied the runes that Teft used for voice activation. There were multiple runes at work in the process, one rune for recording a sound, another that constantly listened for similar sounds using mental mana, then finally an activation rune that triggered when the recorded sound was detected. I copied all of them. I didn't have the ability to use sound mana, but I didn't need to. I just transferred the necessary mana right out of the tile beneath me. Damaging school property for the test probably wasn't going to get me into trouble, especially considering how badly we beat up the arena during the duels. Still, I'd fix it later if Vellum asked me to.
Ms. Winter!
Was there anything else I needed to do?
I began etching another rune. If I had time, I could give this more functions. Maybe build in a shield? The item probably had a high enough capacity for both the return function and a low-level shield. I clenched my fist as I began to transfer mana into the first sigil for building a shield.
What else was I forgetting?
I felt like there was something important.
Mr. Cadence!
I wasn't done. There wasn't nearly enough time. I packed away my tools, gritting my teeth as I stood. What else did I need to do? I was halfway to Professor Vellum. I stopped, paused, and sent a flicker of mana into the sound recording activation rune. Then I leaned down and whispered into it, "Return." I deactivated the rune. If I hadn't recorded a sound, the item would have been completely worthless. I breathed a sigh of relief. I finished walking over to Vellum. I was ready now.
"What have you got, boy?"
I handed her the circlet. She turned it over in her hands, frowning.
"What's this nonsense?"
"It's a return. I know what it is. Or what it's obviously supposed to be. You tried to improve on a return bow, yes?"
She folded her arms. I felt pretty confident in my choice. It seemed like the most important thing to have in the spire was an escape route. Vellum waved the circlet.
"And you thought you could improve on a decades-old design, did you?"
I nodded. "With respect, yes. Return bells are still useful, but there are always places for improvement."
"And how much have you tested this new design?"
I winced at that.
"Well, I haven't tested this specific..."
She cut me off with a wave.
"So let me sum this up. You decided the most important thing to bring with you was an emergency exit. However, that was boring, so you made an untested change to the core functionality of the item. If you made it incorrectly, the item is completely useless, and you potentially won't know until you are in a life-or-death situation. Is that about accurate?"
I took a deep breath. This was not going well.
"I have tested the individual components before, and I am reasonably confident that this method of combining them will work."
She waved a hand.
"Enough of that. Where's your teleportation anchor?"
I hadn't made one of those. But I still had the one from the original bell, and in theory, since I'd moved the anchor rune from the bell over directly, I wasn't sure if it would still work, actually. I pulled out the anchor and handed it to her. She glanced it over, turning it in her hands, and then handed it back to me.
"A standard anchor. Passable."
Should I tell her I didn't make it in the class? She has to know, doesn't she? But she didn't say anything.
I stammered. "I'm not done talking to you." She handed the circlet back to me. "I'm disappointed, Cadence. You made a number of mistakes here, not the least of which was your choice of item. I mentioned in the scenario you were going up with climbers. Undoubtedly, one of them would have a bell."
I started to open my mouth to object, but she waved a hand.
"Just listen. In spite of that, a return bell was not a terrible option. If you had experience making them, and the skills to make one on your own. I'm not going to fail you for transferring mana out of an existing item for the test, nor will I fail you for stealing mana from the tiles. Those are both valid strategies, and clever ones at that. But when you're only allowed to bring one tool for something, it's important to make certain it works. There is a time and a place for experimenting, but it must be done in a safe, controlled environment. If you had truly brought this item into a spire, you would have been gambling with not only your life, but the lives of others."
I couldn't help myself from interjecting. "I also wouldn't have gone into a spire with one item."
"No,"
she shook her head.
"I believe you wouldn't. I've seen a number of other items you've built, and as we've discussed, many are creative. But your particular brand of excess has another flaw. As you grow more powerful, you'll find that having too many items causes them to interfere with one another."
I nodded. I'd studied that a bit, and taken it into consideration with the placement of my multiple shield sigils to make sure they didn't cause any problems with each other.
"I can consolidate down to a smaller number of items as I grow more skilled.
Or I could just keep storing things in the Jaden box." But she didn't need to know that.
"Be that as it may, this test was about preparing one item, not many. In that regard, you have failed, not because you are a poor enchanter. In fact, your item shows a higher degree of skill than most of the class. Your failure is in judgment."
I winced. "I see. So I failed the class, then?" She shook her head.
"No, you failed this exam. Your score for the year going into this test was a B average. I will give you enough points for this exam that your final score is a D.
Failing you out of the class would only make you more likely to make mistakes in the future, and thus, this once, I will be merciful.
I took a deep breath. Thank you, Professor.
She handed me the circlet.